Fans, we are back live with another edition of the Cheapy Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jack Kilby, Executive Vice President of Great North Wrestling. And we're very pleased to have a man, a special guest today, an individual who has a fascinating story on many levels. Many will know this man from his tenure in the Philadelphia wrestling scene, but also other locales. He's an ECW original, and he is known as the Iron Man, Tommy Cairo. So before we get to Tommy, as per the custom here, I'm going to throw over to my partner, Morris, over in beautiful Ireland.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you so much, Tommy, for coming on today. Really looking forward to this one.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to have a forum and to still be asked to do anything after so many years is awesome, you know. But, you know, I think we talked before the show started, and what I wanted to do is touch on where I'm at right now. Recently turned 66 years old, but we're going to go back 2 years ago, what would be 2 years ago this September, so a year and a half plus. I contracted sepsis. I got stung by something in the water and it got infected. And long story short, without the gruesome details, I lost my left lower leg below the knee. So I have a below the knee amputation, which means I have the mechanics of my knee, but I have an artificial foot boot thing. Long story short, I should have been dead. According to the doctors, I don't remember anything for a week before everything had to be told to me afterward. So for a week, I was in sepsis shock and just carrying on doing regular stuff. And my last thing I remember is my son dropping my son off at youth group and saying, I think I know why my leg hurts. I think I sprained my ankle because it didn't bother me. My wife said something about, all right, so rewind a little. I got stung in the water. I have a place in Virginia. I got stung in the water. And I had this pale line. It looked like a state on my leg, a long, thin area. And it was only just a thin line. The whole thing wasn't like red, you know. I didn't think nothing of it. You know, I'm one of those idiots that, you know, until there's pus coming out of it or, you know, it's a gaping wound, you know, I don't bother with it. The problem is, as you get older, that's not a good thing. You know, you're not invincible and you got to take care of things. So without me realizing it, my wife said, like I said, I had to be told all of this. Anything I'm telling you here out, I had to be told that she said, I'm taking you to the emergency room. Apparently my toe was turning color, one of my toes. So I wound up losing the leg. All right. So like, I said previously when we talked earlier, I got my leg amputated in September. I was in on my back for 90 days, bed sore and everything really bad. I was in a wheelchair with no leg for 9 months, and then I had my leg for 3 months. I was just starting to like work the fit out and get around, and I fell in my hallway on a tile floor and broke my 15-year-old prosthetic hip. Because rewind 15 years ago, I got both hip replaced. So I break that, and I break my femur. Replace my hip, fix the femur, down on the prosthetic, they put a cable around my femur. Then about a month later, I'm having chest pains. Long story short, 4 times in 4 weeks, I was in the hospital, in and out, in and out. Until I finally figured out I caught some kind of viral infection and I ended up with a liter of fluid around my heart. And I was near death. They drained my heart. They gave me a clean bill of health. I got released, got some more testing done. As of right now, I'm good. So I dodged numerous bullets. Then I just found out I was in a little critical area with my prostate, not to get, you know, but these are things that happen when you get older. You know what I mean? And like people, you know, want to say, or my wife would want to say, well, look what you did. Look what you did to your body. And look, I know guys that didn't do anything like I did, and they're more, you know, screwed up than I am. So who's to blame or say it's a little late for that? You know what I mean? But when you're putting yourself through tables and, you know, breaking shit and using your body to do it and having fun, if I had to work light, I would not want to be in a business. It fed what I needed, you know what I mean, without going out and having a street fight. And it was aggression, and even though it was, you know, put on, you still had to get in a mindset. And, you know, when you're having a double dog collar chain match and it's your good friend, but neither one of you want to look stupid, and I'm not selling any phantom shit, and I don't expect you to, so if you miss, make sure you connect the next time, you know what I mean? I'm not that light stuff. I like to work tight. You know what I mean? Not disrespectful, but tight.
Snug, as they say. So you truly are living the Iron Man gimmick both in and outside of the ring. But
yes.
I think it's the fans enjoy hearing for a baseline question about whether or not growing up you were a fan of the business and what territories or workers, wrestlers did you, inspired you, so to speak?
Well, the answer is I became a fan at 8 years old. I watched wrestling for 2 years before I got to see it live. Check this out. How old are you?
Myself?
Yeah, you're like in your 40s?
I'm 35.
I just turned 50.
50. I'm 66. So here's the scene. I'm watching wrestling for a couple years already, right? It's a Saturday morning, 12 o'clock, Channel 9, wrestling, Washington, D.C. Ray Morgan is the announcer, right? Commentator. They've been talking about this match since at least last week and the week before. Bruno and his kayfabe cousin, who was Tony Parisi, Antonio Pugliese, okay? Supposedly his cousin. So there was going to be a tag team, Baron Sekulina and King Curtis made it, I think. And they announced it the week before, so we're waiting for this tag match, and they announced it. The tag match is coming up next with Bruno and his cousin, Antonio Pugliese. So they announce the heels are out there. They announce Antonio Pugliese. He comes out, he's jumping around, and from, you know, Abruzzi, Italy, you know, now out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you know, 255 pounds, the WWF heavyweight champion, Bruno Sammartino. He's not there. So they're like, well, we don't know. Wait a minute. And a guy comes from the side with a little piece of paper, and he reads it, and he goes, well, it seems that Bruno has missed his connection and doesn't look like he's going to make it here today. So what do you think happens? The heels put the boots to Pugliese. Right, all of a sudden, the announcer turns. Wait, what is it? It's Bruno. Bruno comes running in. His jacket's hanging off. He's got a suitcase with a tie hanging. Now runs in, street clothes. What, Bruno just came in from the airport. He gets up in the ring, and they're back to back, him and his cousin, and they fight the heels off. And I'm screaming, you know, I'm screaming. My mother's like, "What? What's the matter?" She come running in. I said, "Bruno," she's just thinking, oh my gosh, she's making me freaking nuts with this stuff. So what did she do? Instead of trying to stop me, she said to my uncle, because I was a fan, I guess because of my uncle, or I knew he was a fan, and she said, well, can you take him to the matches? So he took me to my first show. It was Newark Armory in Newark, New Jersey. And I saw Bruno, and, you know, I patted him on the back coming out of the ring, and you know, I was gone after that. That was it. I was off to the races. I mean, back then it was hard. It was different. You had UHF, ultra high frequency. You had to put a certain antenna on your TV and get channel 41, channel 47. My buddy and I, Phil, who I've been in the wrestling business with shows and promoting, and we left because we used to watch it, and the commentary was coming. It was coming from Los Angeles, the Olympic Auditorium, and it was come in Spanish, some of the shows were in Spanish. And I mean, we remember and repeat the Spanish commercials for the coffee, Bustelo, and you know, they had this big Puerto Rican woman with big breasts, Edith Chacon, and she came on like either before or after, you know, and she would have a dance party going on. Then they had this thing, Sabado Gigante, Big Saturday, and they'd be at this like party with people dancing and crazy stuff on UHF. So you had to go, you know, on the channel 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 13 UHF, U. And then you got the other dial and you turned it. And that's how you got those channels. There was two of them, channel 41 and channel 47. And they both aired pro wrestling. So, you know, back then it was a lot harder to be a fan because, you know, you had magazines, you had newsletters that were very rare at the time, but they had one or two. And, you know, you got a lot of your information, you got late, you know, after the fact. You know, there was no, we'll hear by 11:30 tonight what the results were. And then, you know, of course, once you knew it was a work, you still loved it because it didn't matter. You know what I mean? It didn't matter. By the time you figured it out, you already figured it out subconsciously a long time ago. You know what I mean? You can't jump 6 feet in the air off of something and land on somebody's throat with your knee and not kill them. You know, it just doesn't, it can't happen. So the fact that you can still do that physically, look like you did it and not hurt the guy, that's the art. That's the amazing part, you know. But to get that effect, you gotta be tight. It's gotta be tight. If I see two guys today and they lock up and it looks like loosey-goosey, it's stupid. You know what I mean? As a commentary person, I'd have to make an excuse if I'm doing commentary for a poor lockup. I'll make it, you'll know. I'll say, well, you know, sometimes you would think that this should be really firm, but sometimes they're loose because they're not sure which way they're going to go. Like you would have, you know, you'd have to cover that up. I would feel the need to, you know, rather than just say, what was that? That was shit, you know. Anyway, don't let me get too far off track. Where are we at?
I was going to ask you what you said. Obviously, you're a fan from early childhood.
In the 60s, like, let's say, mid-60s was my beginning.
What was the factor that made you decide to become a wrestler, pursue it as a career? And can you talk in there about your training process and how that was executed?
Sure. So, all right, so here I am, you know, I'm 10 years old. I go to my first live match. To go through the years, you know, I don't know if I was like, I was always addicted. Magazines. Like, I remember when they just went from 50 cents to 60 cents. That's what I remember buying. I had a couple that were 50 and then they went up. I remember my father saying, they're 60 cents now, you know, because I would say that. If you go out, pick me up a wrestling magazine. And, you know, that was my real passion. I got so absorbed in, you know, all the ratings in the back. And like Ring Wrestling Magazine had the best results. You know, Keystone Buckeye Wrestling, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio. You know, and you would read about these guys and maybe never really having seen them. And then eventually, in your quest for more info, and when wrestling came on TV, I remember when Southwest Championship Wrestling came on. I was in my 20s, and I knew it was a work. I wasn't in the business yet, but I was like so excited. I was like, what's this? You know, we got this constant, you know, product of Vince and his father that for so many years that anything we got that was beyond that was like heaven. Like these kids, everybody today that's a fan, they got it so easy. And I'm loving it because I could go any era I want and find my fix. You know what I mean? And it doesn't lie in too much that's recent. I like the 70s. I like the 60s, 70s, and a little bit of the 80s. I broke in 86, and I caught the tail end of some of the, not territories, but there's still a couple of loops going on that I got to do and got to travel a little bit, you know, and it was still, if you really worked at it, you could still work four nights a week then, you know what I mean? And have a regular job and they let you go. Like, I was in the union. I was like a superstar to them. You know what I mean? Hey, did you go, you're going to see the kid? Yeah, I was a kid back then, imagine. You're going to see the kid. He's down tonight downstairs at the Robert Street Hotel. Yay. You got to go. It's a blast. You know, and I was body slamming my best friend on cardboard on the job. Kids remember that. I remember when you were slamming the guy on. We put all this cardboard in a pit. I said, come on. I told my buddy, just give me a little jump. You know, my friend Mark, rest his soul. Sorry. And, you know, that's my been my whole life. When we were kids, I was dropping the kids in the neighborhood on their heads and stuff. You know, it was crazy. That's just the way it was. So am I going to have to, can I, even while we're live, I got my family here. I'm going to have to go downstairs, I guess, right? All right, good. I'll stay here.
All good. Can you talk about your who trained you in that process?
Well, so let me. So going ahead, I'm like in my early 20s, and I did try at one time to contact somebody. I don't remember who it was originally, but of course I got no response. It's not like today. If you got $1,500 or $2,000, we'll start you out. And then when you graduate, you're a wrestler. You know, it's a whole different ball game. What did you have back then? You had Vern Gagne. These were camps. These weren't schools. Vern Gagne. Down in Florida, you had Hiro Matsuda. Right? You had Ed Sharkey. Right? You had all these guys that trained the main people in the business in the 70s, 80s, the Funks, you know, all these people, you know, it got so watered down that it used to be, if you tried to open a school and you weren't legit, meaning you didn't have a bloodline or you know, a pedigree to look back and be able to tell me and is verifiable, you were trained by, they'd run you out. You couldn't open up some school and just call yourself ABC Training Academy and nobody knows who you are. They would never allow it. But now it's like, who trained you? I trained over at Acme training facility. Who trained you? Oh, Joe who? Joe Smith. Who's Joe Smith? What's his working name? Do I know him? No, well, you know, he didn't really work that much, but he's a trainer. So that's where it starts, the breakdown. Now, that being said, we cannot sit around and ridicule the kids today because it's not their fault. It's a different business. I was making $100 a shot in 1986 because I was brought in by the right people when a time where it was a closed business. You know, I had to bug my mother's best friend's nephew, who was Pete Reeves, worked for the WWWF. As he looks like a Pete Reeves, Steve Reeves look alike. And I used to go bug him when I was like 12 and 13. And, you know, I forgot my point. Where was I?
You were just going to talk about when you actually started training and what it entailed.
All right. So I was an Olympic style weightlifter, right? I mean, the clean and jerk and the snatch in competition. They got rid of the press after the 72 Olympics. So I actually lifted for the first time on a lifting platform in 1971 at about 110 pounds. Clean and jerking 165, you know? So that's where my training, we had an Olympic champion in my neighborhood and we had a free gym, town gym, and everybody for 30 years worked out there as kids, you know. So that's where I started. And then I got tired of, I didn't like the way it made me look because you weren't training like a bodybuilder. So you would get big traps from all this. You would get big triceps, no real biceps, and a big butt from the squatting, and big legs. And, you know, it wasn't a good look. And I always liked bodybuilding. So rewind to me 2 years old on a blanket in Florida, holding up a bodybuilding magazine with a guy like this in a lat spread too. So already, that's what I thought a man was. That was a man. You were big, you were strong. You lifted weights at a time when nobody did it. My father was into it. Ex-Marine, former Marine. So I had that background. And then I had martial arts. I started also at 12 years old. And I was wrestling in junior high. I was doing all of this stuff at the same time. And, you know, I had to pick something. So I wound up doing Olympic-style weightlifting. And then I went into bodybuilding. I won the Mr. New Jersey in 1983, the middleweight division. A year prior, I sat in the audience drinking beer. All right. And I was just finishing up with the Olympic lift and was transitioning into bodybuilding. And I saw a guy I knew that got third place. And I'm like, I could beat him now. They're like, yeah. But I couldn't because I was muscular and I was working out. Just wanted to switch gears a little and get the right, all the muscles equal instead of looking all out of proportion, you know. Because you don't specifically target muscles like you do in bodybuilding. With Olympic style weightlifting, the training's different. It's rudimentary, you know. So I made a transition, and I said, next year, I'm going in this class. I figured I'd be in that class, middleweight, and I'm going to win it. They're like, you never even competed in bodybuilding yet. Well, guess what? I did. I beat 33 of the best guys in the state. I had to qualify to even go into Mr. New Jersey. 3 months prior, I went to Connecticut and won first place in Connecticut. Then I came here and I won my weight class in the Mr. New Jersey, 1983. 1984, I competed. 1985, I was in the Mr. America. I was a top 10 finalist. Then 87, 86, I was already transitioning into the business. I came off the 85 Mr. America and I bulked up again, but I was still, you know, so it's summertime. A couple weeks prior, I'd seen an article in a wrestling magazine, the Wrestling Eye magazine, which was like a semi-smart magazine back in like the 80s. My good friend Carmine DeSpirito was involved in that. And so I saw an article and it said, the EWA in C. Warren, New Jersey. As a kid, I was so crazy. I would look in the back where they would show you ads from recent cards, and I would call those buildings and ask them what's coming up this weekend and write stuff down. I was out of my mind, you know, as a fan, and it was hard to get the information. So anything you could get, you got. And I said, let me see that. Maybe I'll call information. Back then you had information, you know, 411. Hello, information. Can you give me the number for Eastern Wrestling Alliance? C. Warren, New Jersey? Well, I guess I'll connect your call. I'm like, so, hello, this is Dennis Glam. I'm like, hi, this is Tommy Cairo. I said, nothing. Cut me right off. I said, I'm interested. I'm going to get into business. I saw your article. Nothing. So then I saw they were running a show in Seaside Heights, New Jersey, on the boardwalk at the Weaponana Sports Complex. So I go down there and I'm sitting there. You know what this is called? The block pose, they call that. An old style bodybuilding, weightlifting, strongman. The block pose. I'm standing there, I got shorts on, everything's, yeah. Nobody looked like that. You didn't see too many guys walking around like that. So they approached me and that was the guy from the picture, Dennis Glam. It's Dennis Glam. Jimmy O'Brien and Murdy was Dennis's wife. Good people. And they said, yeah, we saw you back there. You look really good. You're in some good shape. I said, yeah. So, did you ever think about getting into the wrestling business? I said, yeah. I said, I called around a couple of times. I said, and I got nothing but the cold shoulder. They said, who did you call? I said, you. They said, really? I said, yeah, I called you and you blew me off. Well, we have no idea what you look like, and it's not that kind of business that you just walk into. So we got a little training going on. I said, well, if it's anybody I watch, because I watched a couple matches, I'm like, I could probably do what they're doing already. Because I could. I literally could. Been doing it since I was a kid. I had an amateur wrestling background, martial arts. I was a bodybuilder already, a weightlifter, you know. So they said, well, would you? I said, one guy impressed me, and it was Rocco Rock, Ted Petty from Public Enemy, Cheetah Kid. And they said, he was wrestling under the hood, the Blue Max. And they said, yeah, it's him. I said, well, yeah, I'm interested. So I trained for like a couple months. I was out on the boardwalk working out in this little arena thing. And come to find out, Gary Capetta, his family owned that pier. And I knew Gary from as a kid. That's part of, I didn't tell you the story. Growing up, 17, whatever, 16, 17, I was going to the matches. And then I got a job at West Orange at the South Mountain Arena, and I would be there for all the shows. And I got to know Freddie Blassie. They got to know me as like the kid that comes around, and the kid that works at the arena, you know. So they knew me, you know. So it wasn't until I started coming around with some of the wrestlers that were working for Vince McMahon, Tony Colone, Pete Reeves. Then I later met, of course, Davey O'Hannon, Mike Cicluna, all these guys that groomed me, that were still in the business, in the ring, when I broke in. So Ted Petty brought me around all those people. You know, Teddy sent me on the road with Davey G, the masked Russian. Dave giggled. He worked for the old Morton Downey show and did security. And we would go do these loops up in New England, take the ring truck, make the dates, stay in a hotel, break the ring down, work out, you know, and come around. And that was the good way to learn, you know, having respect for the business. And you didn't worry if you had to drive, set up the ring, wrestle, take down the ring, drive, get an idea. They're trying to give you an idea what it's like when it wasn't as much like that. You know what I mean? So I was very lucky that way.
Tommy, there's a lot of fan questions coming in for you though at the moment, and I'm going to just jump forward a little bit. Someone wants to know in the chat there, are you happy that Paul Heyman is getting inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame for his work with ECW?
That just goes to show you how much of a joke the WWE Hall of Fame is. Here's a guy owes people so much money, and here's the thing. If the people that he owed were all in good shape financially, I'd say, well, no harm, no foul. Still no good. But there are many of them who could benefit from just what he owes them, let alone if it was ever in any kind of an account gaining interest or a fund or anything. And I think it's a joke, because the more I thought about it, even today it came up, I thought about he stole from so many other groups at the time, including, it's an offshoot of TWA that they were already doing. They had Bruiser Brody, they had Carlos Colon, they had all these guys, you know, Cactus Jack. They were all doing this stuff in TWA. And then you saw what was going on in FMW, you know, and I had those guys at my house. I had Matsunaga at my house. I had a couple of those guys at my house. And I was showing them tapes of what I was doing in Japan with the UWFI. And they were in shock, because it looks like a shoot, because it kind of is a shoot. The Japs are trying to take you out under the guise of it's a work. Oh, you take good kick about 5-6 minutes. Yeah, take good kick means you have a scale on that, you know, a dial on your kick? No. So you go, oh, so sorry. Like, you're really trying to kick my head off, you know. But, you know, that's the way it was there. But in all those other little groups, you had IWA, you had Wing, you had FMW. you know, they were all doing that same style. It's been going on. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Tupelo concession stand brawl. You know what I mean? I just mentioned a little while ago, Bull Curry, I'm reading his book. Check him out. Check out the original Sheik. Check out Abdullah the Butcher. Check out Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I think I did had a good body of work that around the restrictions that were placed upon me once Paul Heyman took over. So this is all to answer the question about Paul Heyman. No, I don't think he deserves it, but it's the WWE Hall of Fame. What does that tell you? It's all crap. They're all going to burn, okay? The people are going to burn in hell. It's going to get deeper. It's going to be commingled with hip-hop. A lot of people are going to go down, okay? And you know what? Good. It's about time. It needs to happen. You know, there's too much good to go on in this world to let these people take over. You know, not getting into anything too heavy, but we got to get this world straightened out. And wrestling's been long been a place where, you know, predators dwell and lots of shit goes on that I never was a part of. See, what people don't realize, like, I never went in the ECW arena the back way when I worked there. Because that's how things weren't good. Things were going on. If you parked your car in the front early enough, you could do that. I would walk in the front door, either have my girlfriend at the time, who's my wife now of 32 years, okay, who I was faithful to, not like a lot of other people. You shouldn't get points for that. That's a given. You're supposed to be faithful. You know, you can't, oh, I was faithful at least. Well, what the fuck? You're supposed to be, you know? So nobody gets points for that. And these guys, if you've been doing something in a room with a girl that's underage and it's not just, you know, a couple year difference and you happen to actually like each other and there's more than one guy in a room, like there's, it's not good. And a lot of guys are going to, a lot of people are going to get hurt behind this WWE. But I don't want to get into that too much. Let's get back on track. Where was I? I think it means nothing. I think it means nothing. To me, like I got an award from Tommy Fierro's group, ISPW, for Lifetime Achievement Award. And not too long before that, Matt Tremont, H2O Wrestling, did a tribute to the 25th anniversary of the Singapore Caning match, which myself and the Sandman started. And you know, there's a lot of respect there, and I appreciate that. But I'm only still around so I can maybe do something positive for the business. We can't sit here and say this, that, and the other. Like I said, because we can't blame these kids because it's not what it used to be. So we got to help them. You know, they need help. It's easy to sit there and say, oh, it was this, it was that when I was doing it, and we didn't do this, and we didn't do that. Well, how about, if you're going to say that, how about giving us the benefit of your wisdom and telling us why you wouldn't do that? What's the reasoning behind that? Could you tell me? That's what you got to look at. Like when somebody comes up with something in the locker room and I hear it, I can say, why are you doing that? Tell me why that has any meaning. You can't try to have a storyline in your head that you have like this thing planned out because you got one show. You're doing an indie show. Most of the time, they don't even have a second date set up. So there is no storyline. All your storyline has to take place that night, right? So the business is hurting, and I don't want to be one of those guys that stands around and complains and doesn't make himself available. If people still ask me to speak, to do it, and that's what people don't get, these guys out there. You would say in my age bracket or whatever, it's an interview. That's a view from the inside. that doesn't mean that every time we get to a tricky question, you're like, oh, I'd rather not talk about that. Well, what do you want to talk about? Why are we having you on? It's an interview. You get it?
We've got, again, a bunch of fan questions, so I think I'll hit you with this one, because this one's kind of interesting. The fan is asking, Jerry Lawler hit Tommy Dreamer really hard in the testicles with a kendo stick. Tommy had to be rushed to the emergency room. We all remember that one. Wondering if it was a receipt for what happened to Angel Amoroso. And he goes on to say here, there's a picture of a young Angel with Jerry Lawler. I'm assuming it's from TWA days.
Yeah, Angel's a good friend of mine. I know her for years, okay? And I love her to death. So I don't know a lot of what's gone on in her life because I'm not privy to it. So we did a show for a little while on Monty and the Pharaoh Network, and things just didn't work out. It had nothing to do with her and I. It had to do with her and I and them. It just didn't work out. And I'm not forsaking a friend of many, many years just because you happen to have a problem with them. And I only know you a matter of years, or not even. So I'm not like that. I'm loyal until I have an issue with the person myself. That's between us, you know. I hope that was a receipt. I'm not really familiar with that exact situation occurrence, but a lot of stuff went on behind my back, and I'll tell you why. Again, I went in the front of the building, not the back of the building. I stayed across the street from the Travelodge. I didn't co-mingle after the show. I usually drove home to a place in Tuckerton, an hour, and I would drive there and stay over, go home the next day. Sometimes I would go home, whatever. I didn't have a need to hang out with these degenerates. So, and really, that's the truth. So they hid a lot from me. I found out later on a lot of things that were going on that happened in the match where Angel was injured that I didn't even know. I was selling on outside the ring. So when these guys that want to talk about how they reinvented the business, like a Shane Douglas or any of these guys, when it comes to the fact that they went into business for themselves many, many times. They did it to Dennis Corluzzo. They did it to me. No worker should have to go into a situation not having full view of what everybody's going to do. And it's not a shoot. You know what a shoot is? When the guy is aware that it's a shoot, not when you cold cock him from the side or you hit him from the side or take a cheap shot. That's not a shoot. That's a sneak attack. None of us should have to worry about that going in a ring. That's going to happen. So if something that was off script occurred, you usually would try to roll with it, not thinking that they're going to try to actually hurt someone. Because I would never, ever have been privy and been a part of that or had knowledge of that without clearing the locker room. And, you know, I'll go on the record for saying this. When it came to the ECW locker room, the reason I stayed so long is Paul Heyman was afraid to fire me. He never owed me a dollar, and nobody had the guts to come after me because they all knew that there was very few people, if any, in that locker room that could handle me if we really had to throw down. And they all knew that. And I had a lot of friends, and I'm not including them, but there's a lot of fake tough guys. I saw a thing. There was a picture of Kurt Angle and Taz shaking hands, and the caption said something about, like, I'm sure Kurt Angle went away with that from that with a bad taste in his mouth, whatever that meant. I said, but you know what? Here's what's funny. One totally legit, and someone completely on the other end of the spectrum who tried to portray to be, but in real life, the furthest thing from the truth. Nice enough guy, but no tough guy. So a lot of us go on. That's, you know, a calling card of mine is that I stayed. People think, oh, Paulie got rid of it. No, he didn't. I left. I couldn't even stand up at the time. My back was so bad. I needed some time off. And they weren't going to, obviously, they weren't too happy about me going to UWF. I hadn't been booked in for a week, a couple weeks or so, and I hadn't heard anything. So I started going over there. I took four trips over there. And I went for UWF. And, you know, they didn't like it too much. So it's funny how later on they tried to co-promote with these hard, so-called hardcore groups, stole that, you know, basically rebranded it. TWA was already doing it. What's so genius about that? It's not like they stayed successful for any amount of time. He used people's money, Paul Heyman. So what's so, I don't understand what's so genius about that. Somebody should explain that to me. And it's not a matter of bitterness, because guess what? I'm still alive. I got a family. I live a nice life. I'm retired. You know, it's all good for me. So I don't get too crazy about stressing my point when I say that there's only two people that started the whole hardcore revolution. That's me and the Sandman. And we ran a program for a year before Tommy Dreamer came into the picture. But because Heyman didn't like me for whatever reason, because I wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid. And when he was holding all these meetings up on the, standing up on the stairway, I looked at these guys and I'm like, they're looking at him like he's the second coming. And I'm like, I don't see it. Just like a sleazy dude to me. You know what I mean? So that's my feeling.
It's funny you mentioned Dennis Carluzzo earlier, because I had a question from social media that they wanted me to pose to you because you were there during the time. And that was, what were your, and I think you kind of touched on what your response would be, but what was your thoughts on the moment when Douglas had just beat Scorpio, grabbed the NWA belt, threw it down.
Trash can.
Double cross Dennis, and then did an interview later kind of mocking him, all that sort of thing. How did you feel about that moment in history that is so celebrated now?
Yeah, well, there you go. You made another example of going into business for yourself at somebody's expense. It's a work. Don't you get it? It's a work. Real quick, I'll tell you a story. I saw a video of Scott Hall before he died at a convention, and Lonely Virgil, still alive, was there. And he came upon Razor, I'll call him, came upon Virgil and said, Oh, it's Virgil. It's hard to recognize him unless he's on his back. Now, let me ask you, is that the most asinine thing you could say? Bro, what are you talking about? It's a work. You didn't ever win any championship. They gave you the belt because they thought at the time you might be the person that could put the most asses in the seat. So saying that in front of people candidly, like, so you must actually believe that you're some kind of badass, because you just said, oh, you only recognize him when he's on his back. Guess what? He got paid to be on his back, didn't he? How is he any different than a heel in a movie? You don't look down on that actor and say, oh, he's a heel. He's a piece of crap. You know, it's stupid. You know, it's easy to suspend disbelief when you're watching a guy flying through the air, shooting a gun backwards while he's choking somebody in the other with the other hand. You know? So I don't know. I think the business today is hurting because it has no structure. Everybody's, there's no more, just to enjoy it for what it is. They're more worried about what's going on behind the scenes and what's, you know, it used to be so simple, you know, and it's not anymore. And it's hurt the business. You know, what are you going to do? What can you do after they've done everything? You know, I think the only thing you could do is revert back, take it down a notch, slow it down a little bit. I mean, you know, people can't even register what some of these guys are trying to do. And when you wrestle for other guys and other workers, so you can talk about it and show videos afterwards, or so that two young guys can walk around a locker room for 2 hours prior to the show, walking through their match. If I ever tried to go up to Manny Fernandez and have him duck fake clotheslines in the locker room while we worked at it, he'd be like, go on the other side of the locker room. get the referee, give him the finish. I'll see you out there. Because you know what? When you're simulating a fight, there's no spots. You know what I mean? There's no spots. And there doesn't need to be. And if I need to tell you, I'll tell you. Grab you in a headlock. Here's the thing they do today. You grab a guy in a headlock. They put their head down. They go, two tackles, drop down, leapfrog, hip toss. You got it? Like, we would be grumbling and ask them, ref, two tackles, talk to them, like ventriloquist style, you know. Another thing, everybody's got kick pads, no real shoes, some kind of shorts, and a Megadeth t-shirt. What is this? Everybody's a martial artist. I don't see anybody really kicking, you know. Get some real boots, get some real gear, invest in yourself. Okay, another one. I go to take you out of the corner, right? I take two steps. You got to run the rest of the way by yourself. Why? Why would you do that? The only way for you, especially in an 18 or 20-foot ring, you got to take that guy out of the corner with such force that even in the understanding of you working together, he has to make sure he spins around quick because you send him like he's going through the roof. It's up to him to spin around and get his back in the corner. But you are actually pushing. He's not the fake, you know, running. Take two steps and I'm going to run the rest of the way and hit the ropes. And come. No, I'm going to make it look like go down on one knee, you know, almost fall down, sending him in. He went in so hard, you know, he's stumbling out, you know. A simple art. Check out this psychology. I have to hit you with a move that's devastating enough if I want to do something from the top rope that gives me enough time reasonably to get up there and execute the move. If the other guy is bent over waiting for this guy to get to the spot, it's just, it's so stupid and it's easy stuff. This should not be a weak lockup. It should not be weak. Do 350 lockups right now. I don't care if it takes you an hour and a half, 2 hours. Because your lockup sucks. You know, they don't teach that. They teach beep, bop, 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 bop. You know, guys are assisting guys that lucha style. And, you know, you don't have to assist nothing. I'm going to throw your ass in that ring. And if you can't handle it, then you shouldn't be doing this. You know? And
Tommy, do you... Go ahead, Tommy.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, it's just another question there from a fan. Do you have any memories of working with Jimmy Snuka? What was he like?
The best. Absolute best. So I got a great Jimmy Snuka story. So we're doing TV for the early Eastern Championship Wrestling. You know, like the Cabrini College and the Tabor Youth Center and Kensington Youth Center, actually, back then. And then we had Aztec Club, Chestnut Cabaret, all these little places. And, you know, we would go and do our shows there. And Jimmy Snuka was so gracious. So he said to Paulie, this one Paulie was there, you know, wanted to just, like, let me get splashed and, like, pretty much job me out. And Jimmy said, no, man, this is a good bra. It's a good bra, he said. Made it so that he hit me with it after the official decision. So it was a count out or what was disqualification. Paulie hooked my leg. I took the header and Jimmy went up. But it was already decision was whatever it was, it didn't hurt me. And I appreciated that. But one time we were doing TV and it was, so like you're like the old days, like WWF, used to be WWF at the Hamburg Fieldhouse and all these other places, you know, they would tape like 4 weeks at a time. So those fans would be there all day. And you would, if you were on a big part of the program, you would be on each hour. So if there was 4 hours, you worked four times. So I'm not going out there with the same wet spot on my ass, on my trunks for the next hour. So I had four outfits for each hour. I had a different outfit. had singlets, I had different colors, so on. So I had a couple animal prints. So we're in the back, Chestnut Cabaret, a little back area. And Jimmy Snooker came up to me, and I didn't know him that well then. I knew him, you know, a little bit, but not that well. We got to know each other much better later on. And he said, "Hey, brah," he goes, "I wonder if I could borrow those tights, brah." And I'm like, "Jimmy, I have a different pair of tights for every hour. I'm sorry." And he looked at me, he goes, "Okay, brah." Years later, he said to me, "You know, brother, this is when I got Glacier Freeze with snuff tobacco. Salvatore Bologna would bring it back for me from Denmark or something. And it was tobacco. And you would, like, it was like, oh, you snort it." And he goes, "What is that, bro?" I said, "Snuff. Let me try it, bro." "Oh, brother, you got all the gimmicks, bro." Jimmy was the absolute best. And he brought that up to me. He goes, "I remember, bro, when you had the tights, you wouldn't lend them to me. But I understood. Now I get it." Like, I actually, like, maybe not taught him a lesson, but he learned something from that. Like, not everybody is going to be awestruck. "Oh, Jimmy Snooker wants my tights. I'm sorry, Mr. Snooker, I respect you, but this is my time right now, and I got to wear different trunks for every hour." He probably thought I was hip and nut, you know what I mean? But you couldn't deny me because I looked the part, I played the part, you know. So there was nothing there but mutual respect. Later on, we got bombed sitting behind a bar. It was a rain delay for the Aztec Club. It was this big nightclub out on the river. And the outdoor pool, guys got thrown in the pool and stuff. We were sitting behind a bar down low on milk crates, sipping. By the time the show came on, you know, we were in good shape. We got stopped going over the bridge. The guy, the cop goes, "Is that Jimmy Snooker in the car behind you?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "What are you guys coming from, a show?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Go ahead." We were coming across the bridge like two, you know, maniacs. Jeff Miller, Metal Maniac, was driving. He had Jimmy in the car with him because he used to drive him. You know, I met them somewhere after the show, and we were leaving there. Good times, a lot of fun. Jimmy, you know, I won't even touch on too much his situation, but all I know is we all knew the allegations while we were working in locker rooms with him. And I never suspected anything other than one of the kindest, you know, guys I ever met. So who knows? It was an accident. You know, everybody was doing whatever. You know, you start mixing alcohol and cocaine and all that crap. Usually something like that is bound to happen. You know, it's a shame. But I never saw anything like that with him. I never saw him with anybody. By the time he was in the Indies, when I was first starting, in the mid and late 80s, he never had it. The only person I ever saw with him was his wife when he came to my school. You know, I saw him with his wife. I never saw him with anybody else.
You touched upon your program with the Sandman, and I know you started working him in Eastern Championship Wrestling, and you had all those iconic matches with him, including the Singapore
Kane
match. What was the genesis of that program that you had with him? And out of all your moments with him, what stand out in memory?
How easy I could see what a lowlife he was. I'll say this. My time in ECW was good in the beginning, and then, you know, was good under Gordon. It was good under Eddie Gilbert, and then started going downhill when Heyman got there. Did you ask me how I got started there?
No, we kind of just jumped, but go right ahead and lead into the Sandman from there.
All right, well, yeah, because it kind of is important. So, I don't know, it was like 1993. I was talking to Gary Wolf, Pitbull, Gary Wolf. He was just, I guess, working in Japan, and for some reason he wasn't available. And I asked him, I said, what's going on, man? Like, you know, who's around that's worth, you know, working for? He said, well, I haven't been able to get in touch with this guy for myself. He said, but I heard this guy, Todd Gordon, was doing something in Philadelphia. So long story short, I got a hold of Todd Gordon. He didn't know who I was. I had a pretty good name on the indies at that time, though. In the Jersey area, you know, tri-state area. And he said, well, listen, why don't you come down? He says, I do this show at the Variety Club. It's a camp for kids with issues. And we do a show for them. And it's free, so there's no pay. But if you come down, you could do like a little tryout match. So I was smart enough that I had already been doing this other places. I'm going to bring somebody, if I can, that I've already worked for, with. So I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, would you have a problem with me bringing somebody to work with? He goes, no. He goes, that's awesome. I said, okay. I said, I guarantee you it'd be a good match. So I brought Guido Maritato, little Guido, with me. He was Damian Stone, okay? We got a standing ovation in the sports bar, Philly Sports Bar in Philly. Like a really good little match. But we walked up and down the beach at my place and talked about the match because I knew it would be important because they were talking about this TV and so on and so forth. So I figured, okay, well, you know, we put on a clinic. We had a great match. Todd hired us immediately. And things, you know, things got good from there. Later on, you know, the Pitbulls came, Anthony and Gary. And then later on, Rocco Rock, Ted Petty, and Mike Dorham, Johnny Grunge, all I came up with those guys, you know. A lot of guys from Jersey, Chris Candido, you know, Bulls Mahoney, Bam Bam Bigelow, King Kong Bundy, Larry Sharp, I mean, Dick Worley, Davey O'Hannon, Johnny Rods. I mean, the list goes on and on. You know, these were the people that I came in through, so I had a good start and an easy start. And I didn't have to put too many people over in my career. I offered and did, but like take for instance, Derek Domino, and Harley Lewis, Angel used to, you know, work with them as the Misfits, and we always worked together. And Harley, it was always a singles match, me against Domino. And Harley, he didn't just wanted to be there so I could put him through a table. That's all he wanted was me to put him through a table. And, he, you know, he was over 300 pounds at the time and tall. So I'm short, a little short. He's a little tall. I got to pick him up pretty high and spin him around, put him through a table. But I never failed. And then Domino, I'd say, Domino, let me put you over, bro. I said, you know, no, cuz, no. Like, he liked that role, you know what I mean? And, you know, the heel knows how to get the right heat. You know, it doesn't matter really if he wins or loses, but gives the people what they want when, you know, babyface goes over. But not a starch white babyface. If you look like the kind of guys that's not going to take any crap, you can still beat a babyface. We know that now. We know that since Stone Cold. Or really the first guy was that gimmick before. You know who it was? David Schultz. That's the Stone Cold gimmick. Go back and watch the vignettes of him. It's the early Stone Cold. Abusive to women. You know, that whole, you know, redneck kind of thing. You know what I mean? Takes all kinds, and you know, in this business. And, you know, if you lay with dogs long enough, you know, you're going to get pleased. And I always had my family and I had good support group. And I got out of this thing with my life by the skin of my teeth. I mean, really, that's the truth. Because it's a whole mentality. Like when I was, I don't know about you guys, where you're at. Jack, you say you're what, 50? 50. So do you remember when you first started driving, did you have to wear seatbelts or no?
Yes.
You did. Well, we didn't grow up with seatbelts. So when you first started, we realized that we got to wear them. It felt very odd for me. I felt a little fruity.
Like, it was the same in Ireland.
It didn't feel, it felt feminine. I don't know, you know, because me, I'm 250 pounds. If there's going to be an accident, I'm going to put my hand on a dash and save myself. This is the mentality. This is what gets us into trouble. When you can literally break through walls, you could literally physically do that kind of stuff. I had a super from one. I lived in a high-rise building. Remember Frank Vincent, the actor? He played in so many mob movies. Anyway, long story short, I lived in a building. He lived upstairs, and there was two buildings side by side. They were 20-story buildings. So the maintenance guys work both buildings. So I'm parking and I'm getting ready to go up, and the maintenance guy comes running over. He only spoke Spanish. He grabbed me by the arm and he dragged me. He goes, you come help. So apparently there was a leak, a broken pipe in one of the apartments, and it was coming through and they couldn't get in. They didn't have the keys. The other guy wasn't there or whatever. Because you break down door, and these were big metal security doors. So I'm like, I know by my apartment layout, there's a window, you know, 15 feet away, directly across from the door. Like, I got to make sure I don't go through the door and right out the window. Now, most people aren't going to be able to run through a door, you know, the average person. I had no doubt. I just, the only thing I was worried about was doing too much and not being able to stop myself and go right out the window. Sure enough, I went and bam, I blasted the thing off. I mean, I blasted it, you know. And the guy was like, oh, my God. I'll see you. So, like, my whole life was like that. I was lifting weights and lifting cars and always doing, like, crazy athletic stuff with my strength. Through the lifting, I was already strong, and I nurtured that by being a bodybuilder and a weightlifter so that if I was going to go into wrestling, I know I'm not 6 foot tall, but I'm going to be 6 foot wide. And I'm not going to look small with anybody. Man. I mean, there's plenty of matches you could see with me and Dick Dudley. Alex Rizzo, he's 320 pounds. And you never once look at us and say, well, what is he doing? You know, today, you got these guys that they look like Maurice, you know?
Or even worse, if that's possible. Tommy, yeah, you were going to touch on your friend, the Sandman there.
So the Sandman, the really truth is that when they had Michael Fay, that American that got Kane in Singapore, Paul Heyman came up with this idea. So at the time, he wasn't burying me yet. So he had a whole year to work that out. So one night he came in the locker room and he addressed everyone and said, I need two volunteers. We want to work off this angle with Michael Fay. And we want to work that into a program with two guys. These are kendo sticks. Well, it's not the real name for them, but anyway, kendo sticks. And we're going to use that as a way to have these gimmick matches. We're going to beat each other up. Kane on a pole, dueling canes, all this crap. And then other regular matches along the way, you know, over the course of a whole year. So he said, it's going to be a lot of color involved, and it's not going to be just your head, right? So that means it's probably going to be your arm or your shoulder, like Dusty, you know. So, honestly, I didn't care. You know what I mean? I wasn't super enthused, but I kind of wanted to do it a little bit, you know what I mean? We all thought that a couple gig marks on our head might help us. or if not, be like kind of a little bit of a badge of honor. But I also knew how not to get them, that I would have them for life by doing it the right way, knowing how to do it. And I was taught by someone very early you get in a position and you got to do it. This is how you do it. And it involved a real B&D surgical razor blade that you use in a scalpel, which if you searched around, you could get somebody, a nurse or somebody. Get me a bunch of number 15 scalpel blades. You know, they're the only ones that really work right. And if you made it right, you couldn't go wrong. If you take the blade so you only had the tiniest of piece sticking out, that's all it could go. These guys are taking double-edged razor blades and breaking them in half, making a blade out of that. And the guys who have done it the most, it's a thing for them. It's like a cutter that has a place to do it, and it's okay. Semi-okay. But take a look at George Scott, pro wrestler from the 70s, in a uniform. Post-wrestling career, he had to work in law enforcement. He's got this uniform on, and he's got this head. It's like, you know, what do you say to people? You know what I mean? When you work in a tattoo parlor and you tattoo your whole face and head, I guess you're working in a tattoo parlor for the rest of your life. You know, unless they just let it go to hell because it's starting to be that way. You know, people with their heads, their faces, their hands. You know, I got some tattoos, but I put all mine, you know, where if I want to hide them, I just got to wear a long sleeve shirt because I know that it may mean something at some time. I'm not one of those guys, oh, I don't give a shit. Well, you never know. You might have to feed your family, and the only way you can do it is you can't look like a misfit. You know, if you want to be a responsible adult, parent, husband, you know. So Sandman and I got along real good, and we did a year's program, but I never got the credit for it. It was if we set the table, we cooked the food, and Dreamer and Paul's crew sat down at the table. But I'm proud of what we did. It was inventive, but we took the lead on that. We did the things that we did. He didn't orchestrate every aspect. He said, this is what we need, and you go out and you do it. Like, you watch any of the matches with me and Sam, man, you don't see us talking to each other. We're beating each other with sticks. What's there to talk about? You give, you take. When you think you're taking too much, you make your comeback. If there's a problem, guy will cut you off. That's what it's to it. And if he cuts you off, you decide what you want to do then. You know what I mean? So it's all fun and games until somebody gets their hands stuck in an industrial fan. So when they wanted to try to bury me, I made sure, go check out a match, on a TV match with me and Chad Austin. So now when Chad found out that I was putting him over, first thing he said in the locker room was, Connie's going to fucking kill me. Now, why would I kill him? That's not his fault. But he knows that that's not right. I can't be up here today and then tomorrow I'm putting over Chad Austin. So, yeah, I'll put him over. I beat the living crap out of him and threw him. I said, kid, get ready for a ride. I'm going to throw you from one side to the other. And then when the time came, I slammed him over by the corner and he stuck his feet up on the buckles or whatever, you know. And I just rolled out and walked out. You can't hurt me. I don't care. Pay me. That's all. Pay me. You know, while Heyman was making his... Now, here's the thing. I got a lot of heat right after. So we're in a locker room. He lays this out. Asked for volunteers. It's dead silent. Nobody says anything. I look at Sam, man. He looks at me. We put our arms up. We're the volunteers. I had people come up to me and say, what are you doing? You know, what are you going to do? Anything he asks you to do? Next thing you're going to... I said, don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. Because I knew to get a little step up. And guess what? It was the right decision. Because even though it went kind of foul at the end, I still have that piece of history, which you cannot take away from me. Two people started a revolution that's still going today. And I'm one of them, and the other one is the Sandman. It's not Tommy Dreamer, okay? It's the Sandman and I. So anybody that knows the real history knows that that's the truth. So that's okay for me. That's fine with me, you know. But I'm damn well gonna tell the story and tell the truth. So those same guys that, you know, looked at us like, what are you doing? Carried that on, and still to this day, some of them, which is really horrible. Get out. Get the F out. Okay. Get
out. Tommy, we've just burned through an hour and 10 minutes. And as we suspected, yes, we're going to need a part two. And that seems like an apropos place to cut it off and start the next one. I know you said you'd be willing to come on again and do a part two.
Absolutely. So
if that's the case, let's pick it up from there, sir.
Okay. Like I said, there's plenty more. And I hope that this wasn't too long-winded, and I hope we got through some. I think we did all right, you know, so we can get post-ECW the next time.
Yes, sir.
We still have a lot to cover. Yeah, absolutely.
And again, what we should do is I'll stop for 1 minute and let you get all the questions, and then also get any questions that you have.
Perfect.
I can be quiet for a little while.
No, that's all good. That's what the fans like to see. And we will be in touch and schedule that in the very near future, and keep the fans advised so they can send in more questions. We actually did get a lot. We still have a lot to cover, but until we come back for part two, on behalf of Maurice, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys. Look forward to doing it again. Bye-bye.
Well, fans, that's it for this edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. If you haven't already, please hit that subscribe button and also like this video, and you'll get the notifications as well of all the great content that we keep coming your way, including part two in the near future with the Iron Man, Tommy Cairo. But until then, I'm Jack Kilby for Maurice. Have a wonderful time, and we'll see you next show.